for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Anna.
A couple housekeeping elements. First, there is a gale force windstorm, so we apologize if you hear that. We are in the most wind-protected room of the house, so we don't blow away while recording.
It's extremely Wizard of Oz. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
It is. And also, welcome to our newest Patreon, Kate. We deeply appreciate you and your contact with our community, and we're grateful for you.
Yay, Kate the Great.
Thank you. So, today, we are talking about Warhead and Trials of the Darksaber.
Rebel Season 3, Episodes 14 and 15. We are getting close to the end of Rebel Season 3, baby.
We sure are. So we begin with Warhead, which begins, as several important aspects of Star Wars do, with a Star Destroyer yeeting out a bunch of pods to investigate things. A pod lands on Atalon, and out of it crawls a perfectly normal blue protocol droid who proceeds to walk to chopper base and then is mugged by spiders.
Yeah. Don't forget the most important part there, Sam. There are indeed dead spiders in this episode.
So meanwhile, everyone except for Zeb is going to the field trip. Zeb couldn't get his permission slip signed in time. And so they're left with Zeb, Chopper, and AP5 to inventory the entire base, which is very exciting for AP5 and the opposite of that for Zeb and Chopper. So as they're all trying to avoid doing inventory except for AP5, Zeb gets the call that a meteor landed and booped over one of the stations. Please go investigate. So Zeb's like, I will absolutely do anything other than inventory. Chopper, you're with me. Let's go. They find a crashed pile of spiders as well as a droid and are like, huh, let's rescue this droid. And Chopper's like, we should kill it immediately.
I mean, it is a very sus situation. No one has ever successfully killed one of the Atalon Kryknas. And there's just like a pile of dead spiders and a droid underneath it. And they're like, we should definitely take this stray puppy home. And we definitely should not, my friends. As someone who would love to take a stray puppy home.
So
let's not.
So there's a very minor B plot here, which is that Callus is aboard his Star Destroyer and he gets a message, which is one of our droids has not reported in. And Callus is like, oh, ignore it, which is a change of pace for him. But then Zeb brings the protocol droid back and they immediately put it to work because it's great at doing inventory. It knows exactly how many proton warheads and ration packs and what have you are around. So Zeb's like, this thing's doing great. It doesn't talk back to me nearly as much as AP5. Great work. Zeb then gets a message from Fulcrum, which says, hey, heads up. The Empire is sending out nuclear assassin droids. And they look like this, and one of them's gone missing, so it needs to report back in that it didn't find anything.
As a reminder, Callus is Fulcrum, Fulcrum is Callus. Mm-hmm. His extremely uncharacteristic, it will be fine, was very much like, you rebels are in so much trouble.
So Zeb goes and confronts the protocol droid right as AP5 accidentally order 66s it by saying, ah, yes, this thing's very much helping me inventory the rebel base. And it's like, rebel base, murder mode activated. It proceeds to grow three times its normal size and grow murder limbs and start attacking. And then it like goes on a killing rampage and is vampirizing helpless astromechs who are just sitting there on base until eventually Zeb gets it in a chokehold and AP5 is able to shut it down. However, that is definitely not the end of problems because as soon as it shuts down, its nuclear powered, do not mess with warranty explosive begins, which Chopper literally freezes using a freeze ray.
So it's counting down to self-destruction.
Mm-hmm. They take this opportunity to say, okay, reprogram it so that when it reconnects to Imperial Wi-Fi, that's when it goes off. It'll go back, it'll report, it'll do it in person, and once it's connected to the Wi-Fi, it'll go off. AP5's like, yeah, sure, no problem.
AP5 first says, I'm so sorry that it took me a minute to respond. I was stunned that you had a good idea.
So they let the droid go back to its ship, and then it's like, I'm going to get on the radio and do my Wi-Fi range extender, and Zeb shoots down the Wi-Fi range extender. So the droid flies back to its mothership, and we watch as Kallus is sitting there drinking his tea and reading his reports, and the Star Destroyer next to him explodes violently as the droid goes off inside of it, killing an entire Star Destroyer.
And he just has this little smile on his face.
Yeah, he turns to the window. He's like, what just happened? He turns to the window. He's like, hey.
Incredible.
So as Zeb is reporting back to Hera, like, hey, so this is exactly what happened one day into your training exercise. We cut to Kallus being like, so this is terrible. Like, I can't, they're so wily, those rebels. I can't believe what they've been up to. And Thrawn's like, yes, they've signed the deed to their own demise because it's gone from thousands of planets to only the 94 I sent illegal murder bots to. So now I have a greater than 1% chance of finding them.
Oh no, I didn't do the math on that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very bad.
So that is the end result of Warhead, and AP5 and Zeb are now friends.
Kind of.
Less enemies than before. There's a lot of funny banter.
There is very good banter.
But then we move into Trials of the Darksaber.
There is no banter in Trials of the Darksaber, just training montage, mm-hmm. which is my favorite genre of anything.
This is true.
One time I heard on Book Talk, someone was like, oh, I didn't like Mistborn, but you might if you wanted the Eye of the Tiger training montage to be 4.5 hours longer. And I'm like, yes, that's me. I'm the target audience. This is my episode of Rebels.
And sure enough, you really enjoyed that book. So Trials of the Darksaber.
So back on Atalon, Kanan calls Fen Rao into his room to get a download of deep Darksaber lore, which Fen Rao promptly delivers. Mm-hmm. The Darksaber, which, as you may remember, was in Maul's cavern on Dathomir, and then Sabine beat Maul using the Darksaber, and so the Darksaber technically kind of belongs to her now a little bit, but she doesn't want it. But Kanan was like, yo, what's up with this Darksaber? And Fen Rao was like, wow, this was created more than 1,000 years ago by the first Mandalorian Jedi. It is a extreme status symbol in our society. House Vizsla used it to unite the clans and strike down any who oppose them. And Sabine could use this to raise an army of Mandalorians.
Mm-hmm.
And Sabine is like, what if I didn't, though? I do not want this at all.
She's called to a family meeting, and everyone's like, we need you to wield the Darksaber. And she's like, oh, no, I don't wanna.
What if you did not ask me that? What if we pretended this never happened?
Please.
She does grudgingly agree to try to learn how to use the Darksaber and then go to Mandalore and try to unite the clans. She's 16 years old.
But first she has to learn how to wield it.
Yeah. So.
To the Bendodrome.
Eye of the Tiger starts playing. And it's training time, biatches. Mm-hmm. It goes okay. So Kanan, Ezra, and Sabine set up their training camp in the middle of the Atalon Desert. And Kanan gives Ezra and Sabine 2 wooden sticks. Mm-hmm. And basically they spend a week with Ezra just running Sabine through the basic lightsaber forms. And it's going okay. She's learning kind of slowly. She's under a lot of pressure.
She lacks discipline and focus.
Fen Rao finally drops off more supplies and is like, hey, I brought you these Mandalorian VAM braces to give you an edge. And she's like, oh, cool. And whips out her little electro lasso and trips up Ezra. All good stuff. She then tries it on Kanan and everyone loses their minds. And they have a big blowout fight because Kanan is like, you're not taking this seriously. And Sabine is like, you're a bad teacher. So she storms off into the desert.
Kanan says, these tricks will keep you alive, but you can't rely on them. You need to have some discipline here.
Yeah. So everyone's right and everyone's wrong. It finally takes Hera calling in to tell Kanan, you have not been teaching Sabine right. You haven't been letting her really fight. You've been too afraid that she'll get hurt. But her family on Mandalore hurt her more than a sword ever could. You need to let her fight, and you need to let her face her demons.
And you need to let her unleash the power of the Darksaber.
So, when Sabine comes back from the desert, the real training begins, and the power of the Darksaber is unleashed. There's this amazing drumbeat playing behind this entire long scene. And it's nighttime, and they're in the desert, and they're by the fire, and Ezra and Fenrau are watching as Kanan finally allows Sabine to light up the Darksaber. And they start with a practice series, and they're going like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then they break into this open duel, and Kanan is taunting Sabine to try to get all of this stuff to come up from the surface. He's like, you're not committed. You're going to lose. You should quit. And it all comes out. And Sabine starts overtaking him in the duel. And she's like, I never quit. I only left Mandalore to save everyone. I built these weapons. The Empire took them. They used them against my people. I enslaved them. I enslaved my family. When I tried to stop it, no one would stand with me. They sided with the Empire. I am a traitor. I am treasonous. I destroyed their world. Like, who would ever follow me?
Yeah.
And, like, she finally kicks Kanan down the side of the canyon and holds the Darksaber over his throat and is like, no one would ever follow me. And then Fenrau and Ezra come up to her, kneel down, and say, we would. And Kanan looks at her and says, this family will stand by you whatever you choose. And, like, I am misting up thinking about it. My face was salty from how many tears were pouring down it. I was crusty. I was like an old fisherman on my boat in the high seas with a rime of salt on my rim.
There are, depending on how I'm feeling, two absolutely spectacular lightsaber duels in Rebels, top tier, best lightsaber duels in history. This is one of them.
What do you love about it?
I love, so we'll start with this episode because Warhead has big impact, but is mostly jokes. So I love in this that this whole time, Hera's phoning in and she's saying, you're still practicing with those training lightsabers. What's the dealio? And Kanan's like, well, it's safer. And Hera's like, so you don't trust Sabine? When Ezra learned he was using a lightsaber, like, you need to actually let loose with Sabine. Firstly, because she's like older and wiser and a weapons expert, and she knows how, like, which end of a blaster is up. She knows her way around weapons. Like, the safety is not the factor. It's the emotional side of things that is the factor. So then we get into this duel, this sparring duel between them. And we've seen Kanan fight defensively since he's been blinded. And we've seen him in duels, and he has got this, like, perfect form. He's got his lightsaber out in, like, a fencing pose. He's got one arm folded behind his back, and he's going back and forth. And as he's fighting with Sabine, we see from the get-go, like, at the very beginning, they pick up the training sticks, and Kanan just, like, shoves her aside. And he's like, practice with Ezra. Like, you aren't even worth my time yet. And after Sabine practices a bit, she's able to do a bit more back and forth. But as he goes faster and faster and blocks high, blocks low, and then they begin this open feeling, eventually she stops and she says, it feels lighter. And he's like, he's explaining throughout this thing in a way that we've never talked about in Star Wars, the way it feels to attune to a lightsaber.
I mean, we've never really talked about attuning to a lightsaber at all. Whenever we've seen a youngling or a Padawan learn how to use a lightsaber, no one has ever mentioned the weight or the feel of it or the way that it works. It is so natural to them.
Because the crystal is connected to the Force. And so you channel the Force through it and you through it through the Force. It is an extension of your Force reflection. And the fact that the Darksaber is something so different than a Jedi's lightsaber.
You know, the only time that I can think of that we have covered this in Star Wars at all was a non-canon Vision Season 1 episode where there's a lightsaber maker and his daughter.
Yes.
And they're sparring with the lightsabers and the crystal is transparent when the daughter is wielding it. And her dad says, it's because you are not strong in the Force yet. And over the course of the episode, as she gains more and more control over the Force, her blade gets more and more opaque until finally it looks like a real lightsaber.
Yeah. If you want to hear our discussion on that, join us on Patreon.
Yeah, but everyone has always treated lightsabers, even General Grievous, like they're just fire and forget. They're the same for everybody. Mm-hmm. But we get some fascinating darksaber lore on the way that energy works.
Well, we did know that Grievous was trained by Dooku in the way of the lightsaber. And also he's got mechanical arms, which are infinitely strong. But yeah, the idea of the darksaber carrying this emotional weight with it. And then as Sabine begins to flow with it, she becomes stronger and being surprised by the weight. We did see in one of the Clone Wars episodes, I believe it's the one where Anakin gives Padme his lightsaber because he wants to prove that he's still husband material.
Which one was that?
It's when like Cad Bane takes the Senate hostage.
Oh, season 3.
Is that season 3? Yeah. And then he has to, like, sneak in and punch a bunch of people. And
that might be season 2. I remember the one you're talking about where they end up being held hostage in the middle of the Senate gallery.
Yes, exactly.
And Padme's trying to get to Anakin to slip him the lightsaber.
And she's like, I have this lightsaber. But when she first picks it up, she's like, it's really heavy. And I find that really interesting because it's like when the blade is extended that makes it heavy. And ostensibly, the blade is made of light, which has no weight. But because it is this like coherent energy, it actually does have mass to it. And it lends itself to this dichotomy between the way a Jedi lightsaber works and the way the Mandalorian darksaber works, because they are deeply different. Hmm. And the darksaber being not only visually different, it's got this like katana style blade and it's blacker than night and it sparks when it touches a lightsaber. And as Kanan describes it, he says that blade is old, it's heavy. And so there's this description he has. And as he does, it's like he's going through the Jedi trial in an accelerated or even sort of scattershot way of getting to the root of what her block is from learning.
Mm.
And I know he had to do that with Ezra as well, because Ezra had a lot of blocks to becoming a Padawan.
Yeah, I mean, Kanan describes it to Hera. He says, Ezra was always more eager to learn than I was to teach him. He lacked discipline, but he didn't lack willingness. Mm-hmm. But Sabine is blocked.
And I think that's for a couple of reasons. One is that Sabine is a prodigy in so very many ways that when she is presented with something that she doesn't immediately excel at, she loses it.
Oh, I mean, Sam, speak less loudly, please.
It speaks to, you know, precocious and gifted children everywhere of like, I've done so well, and now that I'm asked to take on a new skill and I don't immediately excel at it, or I don't have like I've been in my career for 10 years. And so I, even if I start something new, I expect to be treated like a 10-year veteran, is a really interesting place to be. And that is where Sabine is when she picks up this blade. In the very beginning, she says like, I know how to use weapons. And Kanan's like, a lightsaber is a very different weapon. And he would know, he uses a blaster all the time.
I guess I got that as a surface level reason for Sabine's hesitation over the darksaber, but it was very clearly one of her many layers of excuses for not wanting to address the deep trauma that she has over her family kicking her out and siding with her enemies and saying, you are worse than our enemies.
And so when he unleashes the darksaber, when he unleashes Sabine, when he starts sitting there and using her combat reflexes to start asking her pointed questions in a combat situation, which he knows is how he gets like straight answers out of her. Like, she's kind of snarky when they're just like flying around to the ghost. But when he's like, did you bring enough explosives to cover this? She's like, of course I did. And here's why. She always gives like the straight answer under pressure. And so he uses that and he cuts and cuts and cuts until all that's left is the truth. And when all that's left is the truth, all that's left is her standing over him, him disarmed. And he's been, you know, defeated. I don't know how much of that fight he was throwing or how surprised he was. I'm sure he would have been able to, like, if he had let the reins loose a little, he would have been able to stop her or shove her away because she's not a force user. But he's left with all she is. And she had to burn away all of the blocks she had between her and a fully actualized her before she would be even capable of wielding the lightsaber. And I think he recognized in her, to her, it's a weapon. And she needs to learn to treat it as such.
I think she begins with the darksaber as a weapon and ends the duel using it as a tool.
Which I think is like, in her head in the beginning, the reason she hasn't picked up the darksaber is because it is something that has emotional weight to her. So immediately, like a couple episodes back, she gets a jetpack and she like puts it on, tries it off. She's like, cool, weapon, new weapon. We see her use that in the Ghost of Geonosis arc. She flies around and gets like 50 kills with the jetpack. Then when Fen Rao shows up and is like, hey, here's some Mandalorian Vam braces I took off a dead guy. These are awesome for taking out Jedi. Knock that Bridger boy down a few pegs. And she immediately takes to using those. So she is this weapons expert. And the block of her using the darksaber is the fact that she actually has the same Mandalorian idea of what the darksaber is as like Fen Rao. She tells the story of the darksaber before she picks it up. And Kanan has to cut through that and say, it's a lightsaber. You have to be incredibly skilled and adroit and powerful to use a lightsaber without being a Jedi. But people do it all the time. They're called the leaders of Mandalore. And you have that capacity. Pick it up.
I love that you talk about Sabine having to burn away what has been weighing her down, because I think there's like a subtle undertone that I haven't seen addressed yet and I've been expecting it to, which is what Sabine is always drawing with her graffiti is the phoenix
the starboard
imagery. And I think it's such a beautiful symbol for Sabine and for her role in the rebellion and for the wider rebellion too. Like, Sabine has a jetpack and flies. Sabine has to burn away her past life and rise from the ashes to do something bigger than herself. Sabine is the phoenix. The phoenix is Sabine.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's very, very beautiful. It's also what I was thinking when I finished Trials of the Darksaber is that if I only got one episode to convince someone to watch Star Wars, I would be tempted to pick Trials of the Darksaber, because I think every critical Star Wars theme is in this episode. You have family, you have the impossibility of standing up for what is right, you have to confront your past in order to come into your own power and do something bigger than you thought you could ever be capable of. You have to trust people. You have to train really, really hard and get really, really good at what you're doing and be better than everybody around you. And you cannot do it without your friends.
Yeah. And that is what the end result of this is that after this incredibly emotionally impactful duel, Sabine does not like give in to her anger or her fear or her sadness. She lets it all fall away from her. And then she looks at Kanan and she's beaten him.
It becomes power.
And yes, and she's left with, okay, and now what? I don't have the leadership. And Fen Rao says, you just proved you do.
I mean, you could see in Fen Rao's eyes, he was like, if I had recorded that and could just play that to Mandalorians everywhere, we would be done. Like, case closed.
There's a really cool moment in that battle where first Kanan disarms Sabine with the darksaber and throws the darksaber across the room and says, you're not even trying. And she reaches out with her VAM braces and electro whips it back into her hand. Mm-hmm. Then Kanan smashes it to the ground and smashes her VAM braces and the darksaber falls on it and Sabine curls over in pain because she's been cut through her VAM braces. Ezra stands up to stop the fight and Fenrau grabs Ezra's shoulder because Fenrau is her priest. He is her commissar. He is the person who knows what it means to be a Mandalorian. And he knows that he can't, no one can train Sabine to be a Jedi, but Fenrau can have a Jedi train her to be a Mandalorian more than she already is.
I think Fenrau recognized that she was going through the crucible. Yes. Like she was going through the flames in that moment. And if Ezra stopped, it would be a kind thing to, it would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah.
But it would not be the right thing to do.
Yes. It would shatter the moment because it is like a unique moment. They're sitting there when Sabine has stormed off. Kanan is sitting there in the Bendu Drome meditating, and Ezra and Fenrau are like chatting and drinking tea, and Sabine comes back and there's a crackling fire and it's the middle of the night. We know the Bendu is nearby because we get to see him
because Sabine goes and has her tantrum in the desert and like kicks one of the coral reefs, and I thought to myself, oh man, she probably just kicked the Bendu,
and the Bendu, it was,
she kicked she the freaking Bendu toe.
Bendu's like, excuse yourself. She comes back, and in this moment where she has the muscle memory, she has the moves, she's built these fundamentals of how to fight with a weapon that's just like this, but now she needs to actually live it, and she starts taking hits. She starts getting her butt whooped by Kanan until she learns how to handle the darksaber. And more than just about any other duel in Star Wars, this one shows the process of learning. And like you said, it's a montage. But basically, to me, the whole duel is the foreshortened version of the montage. From the beginning of the duel, when she picks up the lightsaber, to the end, is all of the lightsaber training that she needs.
You know what it reminded me of a lot was season 6 of the Clone Wars, Yoda's journey, when Yoda travels to the dark force planet in the middle of nowhere with all of the spirits and the witches, and he has to confront his shadow self.
Dark Yoda.
And he gets 3 episodes to do that.
Yeah.
And I feel like we shortened down every single one of Sabine's trials to these 5 minutes by the fire. Mm-hmm. She does have to grapple with her shadow self. And she does have to acknowledge the totality of what her intentions were and what happened regardless of them.
And that's exactly what Kanan says as he's beating her. He says, you're not fighting me. You're fighting yourself and you're losing. Which is like a tough hit. That's a body blow. And then Sabine is like, you're right. What is holding me back from being as good with a darksaber as I am with blasters or explosives or every single other weapon that I pick up and I'm perfect with immediately is myself. So this is the Sabine episode.
Sabine is the beating heart of these episodes. Or she's the beating heart of the Trials of the Darksaber. Zeb is definitely the beating heart of Warhead. But yeah. So Trials of the Darksaber brought up so many deep lore questions that I wanted to run through a few of them.
Let's do it.
So one of the major themes it picks up is the Force for non-Force users. So Hera and Kanan have a conversation where Hera is rightfully pointing out to Kanan, do you think she can't do this, learn how to use the darksaber because she doesn't have the Force? Mm-hmm. And Kanan says, no, it's not that. The Force is in everything, but you have to be open to it. So my question is, do you physically need the Force to fight with a lightsaber? And if you don't, what edge does it give you if you have it?
So, two-part question there. Do you need the Force to use a lightsaber? Obviously not.
Yeah, because General Grievous can use a lightsaber.
And Grievous uses a lightsaber. It is an incredibly dangerous sword. Can you use it to block blasters? I mean, as much as anyone can use a sword to block a bullet or something, like, maybe. You know, a Jedi spent or a Sith spends years of their life practicing with the blade, and they become very good with it. And so, being a non-force user and using a lightsaber, if you've practiced a whole bunch with a sword, you'll probably do pretty good. But then you're fighting someone with superpowers.
Well, you nubs were going to parties. I was training with the blade.
Yeah, exactly. But if you're not a force user or you don't have a very strong will, then a Jedi is going to show up and be like, by the way, I'm invisible. And convince you they're invisible and then cut you and you're out of the fight. So, like, there's layers within layers. And this has been described in Star Wars so many times that, like, there's the purity of the duel and that it's actually a duel of the wills.
Mm.
And so only someone of an exceptionally strong will can win a duel with swords. And that is what it comes down to. Like, Miyamoto Musashi in the Book of Five Rings talks about this. He says, you know, when you have truly found your own spirit, people will recognize that and you'll be able to face down an army and they will surrender.
So, okay, to recap, you do not need the Force to wield a lightsaber.
Yes.
Jedi or Sith or other flavors of Force users have an edge in a lightsaber duel because they have
the Force.
The Force, precognition, connection speed, to living things, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So, here's the flip side of that question. If you are not a quote-unquote Force user,
mm-hmm.
but the Force runs through all living things, can you use the Force?
Great question. Let's put a pin in it. Let's answer a little bit. Let's look at Hera. And let's look at Han Solo. And let's look at all of the great pilots who we've seen who aren't Force users, or let's look at Hunter or Wrecker. All of these people who have something that is just above and beyond what a normal person would be able to do. Hera has this bravery and this piloting skill. Hunter is able to, you know, track a three-toed sloth across two-toed sloth territory in a rainstorm. And Wrecker just doesn't know what it means to, you know, to be too heavy. So there's like, perhaps these people open themselves up with a purity of being that lets them tap into the Force in a way that enhances them without that even being like, you know, a standard, like the weakest possible Jedi. They're still tapping into it a little bit. It gives them just a little nudge here and there.
Because, yeah, that's what Kanan seems to be saying. Mm-hmm. Hera says, you think Sabine can't do it because she doesn't have the Force. Mm-hmm. And Kanan never says, no, it's not that she can't use the Force. He says the Force is in everything.
Yes.
It's in Ezra just as it is in Sabine. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't discount the possibility that the Force is in Sabine.
Yeah.
But no one is talking about whether or not she can wield it. So the line between who's a Force user and who's not, for a minute, was very blurry.
And it still continues to be, as we saw, the Bendu. Right? Because the Bendu is a being purely of the Force and doesn't have a lightsaber. What does that mean? Like, can one train themselves in the Force? Can one really dive into that? And
right.
Grow?
Yeah, that's my question. They're out there kneeling in the desert doing Jedi training, even though Sabine is not a quote-unquote Jedi or a quote-unquote Force user. But if the Force is in every living thing, could you not cultivate that in yourself?
Yeah. And it's probably a little bit of like the 10,000 hour rule, where mm-hmm. if you sat there with a katana and a pitching machine and meditation, you could learn to use a lightsaber to chop baseballs using the Force.
Yeah. Like, what's the difference really between Ezra and Sabine?
And so then you get like the Force is strong, and maybe that's like this person is deeply open to the will of the Force and they're able to channel much more of it because they have fewer preconceptions or whatever. But Is that a learned thing? Great question. So going back all the way, what episode are we on? 150 or something?
Of the podcast?
Yeah, the podcast.
160.
160. So going back 160 episodes of the podcast to Phantom Menace, we talked a bit about how the idea of the midichlorians as introduced and then never brought up again was a really interesting thing to someone of like my age who watched the original trilogy first.
Yeah, and who had high school biology and learned how mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell and midichlorians are the powerhouse of the Force.
That's true. And now what I believe is that midichlorians are symbiotes or parasites on the Force, that like they exist because you have a stronger relationship to the Force.
Oh, we've never talked about that.
Pet theory of mine. But I think that's what they're actually measuring, because it was such a more beautiful world before 1997 for a variety of reasons. And one of them was that anybody could become a Jedi.
Right. Anyone can sit out there and meditate in the desert at night for 60 days or 600 days or 6,000 days and cultivate something inside of them that lets them tap into the universe.
Yeah. And that's like always been true in sword fighting, right? Like there are always people who, especially in lethal dueling, who practice, and then they become so far above and beyond what you think is possible. And it makes it really cool. So I think Sabine has perhaps taken her first steps into a larger world. And I don't know if she has the innate ability to use the Force, but she does have the trained ability of a Mandalorian to use everything she and you and everyone else brought with them as a weapon against you. So she'll make do. And then to finish answering your question, why carry a lightsaber into battle if you can't use it using the Force? Because it's a freaking laser sword. It chops through everything.
I actually didn't ask that, but it is a good question. So thank you for answering that preemptively.
You're like, oh, well, there's a door in the way. And you're like, sucks to suck, door. Oh, that guy's wearing super armor. Sucks to suck, super armor, dude. I'm going to chop off your limbs.
So Sabine, let's finish up our Sabine conversation. Now that Sabine has acquired some level of expertise or mastery of the Darksaber, it seems like Fenrau and Kanan and the fam are going to go trot her out on Mandalore and try to raise an army. How much do we know about Sabine's supposed treason? Like, she talks about how she created weapons that the Empire used against her people. What weapons, when, where, how? Like, do we know anything about that?
Not yet, but we will, I promise. Starting soon.
So at some point in the last 16 years, because Sabine is like 16. Shout out to our rebels, Katniss Everdeen, saving her people at age 16. She made weapons that were then co-opted. Something terrible happened to Mandalore. That's all we know?
So far, yeah.
So we don't know what she's about to go walk into.
No. But we are going to find out next time on Growing Up Skywalker.
Okay. Interesting.
And through a lot of season four.
Interesting. Okay.
Another note of this episode, since it sounds like we're about ready to segue, and I think that this is a nice one. Both of these episodes had the most minuscule, lightest touches of B-plot. Both of these episodes were pretty much all A-plot.
Yeah, they were delightful to watch. I hate the A-plot, B-plot threading. It drives me nuts. It's hard to plot. It's hard to talk about. It's distracting. It doesn't let anybody breathe. These episodes had so much room for people to just be.
What's so funny is that you love Andor, and I remember watching episodes of Andor, and we're plotting them, and I'm like, all right, in the A plot, the B plot, the C plot, and the D plot, here's what's happening.
Yeah, but Andor is masterful. Like, Andor chain-linked that plot together with a finesse, you know?
Yeah.
Which we cannot always say about the Clone Wars.
Or Rebels, yeah.
Or Rebels.
Rebels is good, though. But both of these episodes, I mean, specifically, nothing happens that's outside the action in Trials of the Darksaber. We get phone calls from Hera, but that is to Kanan, who is in the action or watching over it. We're always within 100 feet of the Darksaber, which is pretty cool. But then in Warhead, we're also pretty much always there, except for a few little cutaways to Kallus smirking as a Star Destroyer blows up. So moving into Warhead, when we watched Rebels Recon, Dave Filoni was like, I really am bummed that we didn't have the KX series droid as this droid, because that would have been perfect.
As the destroyer droid?
Yeah. But this idea of like an infiltration, and also in the Rebels Recon, we learned that this is illegal, that Thrawn is just like, I committed illegal action. What are you going to do about it? To send full on like explosive droids out to look for things is interesting.
Well, so for people who did not watch Rebels Recon, let's give some context. What Grand Admiral Thrawn did in Warhead was resuscitate some Imperial outlawed murder blender droids and send them out to 100 planets that he thought were likely places where the Spectres might be calling home. So he asked for neither forgiveness nor permission.
Yeah.
And is just like, I mean, I guess he's doing his job. He's just doing an extra job, which is hunting down the Spectres.
Well, I think that's a big part of his job, but importantly also, I mean, he's sitting there and he's so far ahead. He's like, okay, I cut my search pattern by 90% in exchange for one Star Destroyer, which is honestly better than I could have hoped for, because the Ghost crew would have come up and blown up three Star Destroyers over the next 3 months, just messing with me. So this was actually cheaper to lose that Star Destroyer in exchange for getting the search pattern down to 18% of what it was before, which is pretty wild. It's pretty scary how efficient he was. So in addition to the droids, and this one being quite funny, the idea of this like infiltrator and just like joining, and how deep a breach of trust it must be to the Rebels, because so many times they've been like, you are our friend now, join us. And then this one turns out to be a betrayal.
AP5 is like, ah, yes, we are going to get along famously. And like, everyone is poised to love this droid, and it is actually a horrifying monster. It is very Stranger Things. And I know that this was created before Stranger Things was created.
It's not the first time possibly. That's come up.
Yeah, but like, it shambles around. It sucks out energy from other hapless droids. It's got this long, shambling look.
It gets real freaky, yeah.
It's very alien. It's very Predator. It's very Stranger Things. But to your larger point about infiltration, the funny thing is that we've seen dozens of Rebels infiltrating the Empire and never feel any type of way about it.
It's because the Rebels are the good guys.
Because the Rebels are the good guys. But just think about Cassian Andor's origin story, right? Yeah. After being rescued on Canary, he's just running jobs in Ferrix and wanders into a Star Destroyer, steals a Starpath unit, wanders back out.
Yeah, that's when Luthen asks him, he's like, you just put on a uniform and keep your head down and no one asks you anything.
Yeah, people infiltrate the Empire all the time.
But we get pissed when the Empire infiltrates the Rebels?
Not that we get pissed, but it's almost like the Empire is so big and lumbering that it can handle these kinds of incursions. But the Rebels have like three bases, and it is personal when someone gets inside.
Now, the other thing I think goes to AI-generated content. And so here's my thesis statement and my argument. So the idea that in order to infiltrate the Empire, you actually do have to dress up like a stormtrooper. You have to put on pants. You have to show up and then, like, pretend to be a stormtrooper or an Imperial officer. Like,
on Aldani?
Yeah, or in Kenobi. What's her name?
Tala,
yeah, who like was an infiltrator this whole time. And the Empire is just like, no, we're replacing your jobs with robots. Like, they don't have any spies in the Empire, at least that we never see anyone other than like Space Tim, like give up people to the Empire. And he was just a collaborator, not a true believer.
Well, but Chopper can just paint himself Imperial Navy in red and infiltrate any place he wants. Like, this is how the rebels gain any traction that they've ever had with the Empire, is by siphoning away some of their power.
Yeah. I guess the argument I'm trying to make is that the Empire is lazy about it because they don't actually get ideologically pure agents to go infiltrate rebel cells.
Oh, like it's less pure because they're not relying on sentient believers?
Because they're just doing it using droids and like bulk. They just are going out and they're not doing any detective work. They're just searching everyone at the checkpoint. You know, they're not like really doing anything to follow up. They're not. And perhaps this is why they're the Empire and why they're evil, because they're not actually stopping people from being rebels. They're just finding rebels and killing them.
Yeah, because nothing for the Empire is personal.
And yes.
If you are a rebel, everything is personal because your life is on the line 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Also, I want to point out, this is not the first time and it's not the last time that the Empire has sent out a whole bunch of droids. This is what happened with the Lost Commanders, right? They just happened to find the clones, and Wolf radioed in, and that was when Kallus was apparently still a true believer in the Empire, because he was like, track down every lead.
Yeah, he hadn't met the love of his life yet. Gets personal, and you become a rebel, or you become a rebel because it gets personal.
Okay, so different starting points, but we agree on that, because I think it's super important that the people who join the rebellion do so because they know a lot. They know what the Empire is. No one tries to infiltrate the rebellion because they disagree with the rebellion.
I think the major factor here is that the Empire is big enough that it can be impersonal, and the rebellion is scrappy and under-resourced enough that it has to be personal. Mon Mothma is funneling her personal wealth into the rebellion.
Yeah.
Bail is putting his career and his life on the line for the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Luthen is feeding his life into the meat grinder that is the rebellion to make it go, you know?
Burning himself to make a sunrise.
Yeah, and Imperials clock in and clock out.
Yeah, they really don't seem to be true believers. And even then, like going back to Andor a little bit more, they look down on Cyril because Cyril's like a true believer.
Cyril cares about his job.
Like, I am 150% Maul Cop. And they're like, please stop every single part of everything that you are.
Please do not be a joiner.
Stop existing.
Please do not be excited to go to work today. That's not what we do here.
Yeah, which is another interesting thing. Perhaps that's another thing that's missing in the extremely neat parallels between the Empire and fascism. Because fascism in the, you know, post-1933 sense of what we understand it to be on Earth Prime here is fundamentally so emotional. It is about the emotional tie. It is about the othering of others. And it is about, like, they're taking our jobs, they're taking our women, they're breaking up our nuclear families, and they're lazy and shiftless and ugly. And so we need to be like pushing these others out in order to have something to compare ourselves to and in order to have something for us to fall into if we don't follow some made up ideal made up by our betters. And that passion is missing in the Empire, and I find that really interesting.
Well, that's what's so dehumanizing about it.
It's flaccid fascism.
Kind of. I mean, if anybody in the judge's sentencing room in Andor had spoken up and said, yo, we cannot just send these random civilians to Narkeena 5 to feed the war machine that is the Empire. If anyone had stood up and said this is wrong, then yeah, it would have been an igniting moment, but that's not how the Empire works. No one matters. Mm-hmm. Everyone is a cog in the machine.
Mm-hmm.
You get tossed around. I mean, we'll take your farm just because we want it. We'll put you on a speeder bike and make you test it until it explodes and you die. and it doesn't matter. So like, that's the flip side of fascism.
So the Empire, the rebel era, they're living in late stage fascism.
Yeah.
And we're living here in late stage capitalism, where we're expected to staple on our sunny smiles in order to give away 40 hours a week for someone else to become a billionaire. And everything is expected to be okay. But then in the Star Wars universe, you're expected to not actually have emotions, because it is, as per all the stories that we were told or were told about the rise of fascism in Germany, in Italy, in Japan, that like, if only someone had spoken up. But here we minimize the voices of the suffering so much. There's people protesting around the globe, and it's like, oh, those protesters, oh, those angry Arabs, the angry black men. It's just like, how dare they speak up for themselves? And what we're left with is this 40 atrocities a day.
Yeah. In Star Wars, you are not expected to staple on a smile, and you are not expected to survive. You are supposed to put your head down. And if you make it one more day, that is a victory. And if you didn't, that was your lot. It's not even about surviving anymore.
So as a cautionary tale for what late stage fascism looks like, it's like this, but sad.
This is pretty sad.
It's late stage capitalism, but sad.
There's that moment where Fenn Rau and Ezra are sitting around the fire in Trials of the Darksaber. And Ezra's like, Sabine just needs more time. And Fenn Rau says, the galaxy is feeling really short on time.
Yeah.
We are feeling like we are accelerating rapidly towards some kind of culmination of something. Like, yeah. Something's gotta stop or start.
Man, Fenn Rau gives off such great, like, elder samurai vibes.
Yeah.
Like, I sat down, I had tea with this young guy after I gave a cheat code to his sparring opponent to beat him up. And I'm just here for the show. I speeder biked over and drinking some tea by the campfire. I'm having a really nice day watching a sword fight. This is the best day I've had in months.
You know who also has great lines is freaking AP5.
Yes.
Zeb is talking about something about counting, and AP5 is like, oh, did you never learn how to count? I can teach you. And he's like, oh, I have an idea. And AP5 is like, oh, you can have those?
I don't know if you wanted to help with inventory. I always assumed you were more of a, you know, brutish person for lifting things and carrying things.
So you had muscles, not mental flexes.
Although we did get to see Zeb flex his captainness. Like, he is a good leader when given the chance.
Zeb has always been a great leader. He gives great orders. He stays on task. Mm-hmm. He makes the right calls. It is a tragedy that no one lets him do that more.
I think he doesn't necessarily want to do it more. I think that he, after his episode, Legends of Lasan, he is now a fully realized character, and he's like, I don't need to be a leader. If I were a leader, it would be of my people, and now I'm a pathfinder for my people. So whenever I find a Lasa, I guide them home, to the real home. But he's sort of he's in the third act, I guess, of what he's up to, or second act of what he's up to, where instead of being like deeply damaged, now he's just like, I solve problems and I help out Lasan. I don't know if he's really needing more out of life, which is nice. I mean, because then we see the angsty teenagers who need much more out of life. And yeah. Zeb is however old he is, because he's a Lasat. We don't know how old they live, but he's like, I actually don't feel angsty about any of this.
It does feel like once Zeb knew that there was an entire planet with his people and that he wasn't responsible for the destruction of the entire race, he did kind of move out of that arrested development teenage phase and is now an adult. Yeah. So yeah, maybe he no longer really fits that role with the Spectre family. He has grown into a new role.
Yeah, he remembered what it meant to be. And I think he is, which is cool.
Yeah. Like,
to be a captain, to be an adult, to be a leader, to be a commander.
Speaking of what it's like to be, what do you think it's like to be a bae? What is it like to bay? Let me enumerate the ways.
It's time to enumerate the Baywatch.
Enumerate the Baywatch. Sam, please enumerate what it is like to be your bae by telling us who is your bae.
I'm still... You must stay up all night thinking of these segues.
Don't insult me. This is natural. This is who I am. This is how I be. This is how I
bae. All right. Well, I'm going to choose Sabine.
Yeah.
Kind of obviously.
Heart same.
For... big plot reveal for defeating Ezra, then Kanan at sword fighting. And granted, like, there were extenuating circumstances, but for winning a sparring duel against both of them is a pretty big deal. And for taking on a whole new role, because who was Sabine before this day? She was, what's her number? Spectre 3? Spectre 4? Spectre 4. She's, you know, a pilot, pretty good. She's a weapons expert, quite good. She is Hera's right-hand woman.
She speaks a lot of languages.
She speaks a ton of languages. She causes all sorts of problems.
She's an artist.
She's kind of low on recruitment, but she's done some recruiting.
She recruited Fen Rao.
Oh, okay. So she's 2. So she's good.
Yeah.
And now she's the heir to the Darksaber. Which is like a big deal.
HTTD.
Yeah. So
Her Royal Darksaber Highness.
Yeah. And I think that's really cool that she finally ascended past it, and it shows a really interesting character development in a really interesting time in galactic history.
And she's 16.
Yeah, I mean, that's how old kings and queens are when they go to war.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how old you are when you start killing people with swords if you're going to make a profession out of it. So,
you know, one thing that I really loved about Trials of the Darksaber, and we didn't talk about this, but the fine details in that episode felt like a love letter to Sabine. Like, she's an artist in addition to a warrior, and we get to see her room covered in paintings. Mm-hmm. We get to see her armor, and she's got all this new art on her armor. And there's that really cool 2D animated painting scene where the history of the Darksaber is illustrated. And it's like a 2D animation superimposed on top of our 3D animation. Mm-hmm. And it felt like that was in her honor.
Yeah. It felt like there exists within the Mandalorian culture perhaps this like very beautiful artistic element.
We know there is because we saw Satine's throne room, which was covered in art. I mean, Maul kept her cool cubist portrait and stuck it on his terrible cave on Dathomir.
So this element of art shows that like the Mandalorians live so fully and so true.
Mm.
And that is what Sabine is all about as well.
Except she is so tightly wound and she is so burdened. So I actually think we haven't really seen Sabine living yet. And she now has a new lease on who she can be and who she allows herself to be. Like, I think she will get to be that way now.
Mm.
But has not allowed herself to really be Mandalorian because she felt like she no longer deserved that because she was kicked out, because she was a traitor.
Yeah, I still think she's at an early stage of becoming who she is supposed to be. But she's taken some really big steps recently, not just gaining a jetpack and van braces and just leveling up her entire closet full of Mandalorian murder gear, but also in taking all these things which she has allowed to direct her actions, taking all these fears which have prevented her from acting in certain ways and saying, I release those fears.
Mm-hmm. All right. Alrighty, what are we watching next week?
Next week, we're following up on the Mandalorian thread with Legacy of Mandalore.
Ooh.
And Through Imperial Eyes.
Oh.
Season 3 of Rebels, 16 and 17.
Wow, and then we have 5 episodes left.
Of season 3?
Of season 3. And I think season 4 is short.
It is.
Okay. Would you say we are 2/3 of the way through Rebels?
Yeah, a lot more than that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we're making fantastic time, and then we're going to get married, and then we're going to watch Bad Bats, and then we're going to watch...
yes, and those are of equal importance.
And then we're going to watch Rogue One and the original trilogy. And then we're going to move on to the next couple phases because we have the whole Mando era and then the Resistance era. So we've got a lot ahead of us, but we've also got a lot behind us. So let us know some of your very favorite episodes as we've moved along with this legacy of the Darksaber and infiltration of random androids. Because we even saw some of that in the Clone Wars. Like, this has been a lot of fun back and forth.
Yeah.
Fun project.
On Patreon, which you should become a member of.
It's quite cheap.
It is $3 a month or more if you can give more. And we do lots and lots of bonus audio content every week. We are about to start a book report on Claudia Gray, New York Times bestsellers, Star Wars novel Master and Apprentice, which features dreamy Qui-Gon and baby Obi-Wan, and it is delightful. There's a romance subplot. There is lack of communication. There is angst. There are meditation gardens. It is very delightful. So join us on Patreon if you'd like to listen to that. And follow us on social media because we talk about Star Wars.
Yeah, join us on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Facebook. That's all of them.
That's all of them.
That's all of them.
I didn't know where you were going after that. I was there's definitely only 4.
Yeah, we're not on MySpace, but...
maybe we should be.
I know.
Maybe we should be on Tumblr. Freaking love Tumblr.
Okay.
I've been on Tumblr for like 20 years at this point.
So all of that, and send this episode to someone who is undergoing significant character growth.
Someone who's about to phoenix into a fuller self.
And should go to the dojo to learn sword beating.
Yeah, for real. They need to wander out into the desert and, like, beat cactuses with sticks until they get really good at it.
Beat rocks. Cactuses are innocent.
Oh, good point.
Yeah.
Please don't beat up a cactus
today. Don't beat up a cactus today.
Yes, feel free to beat up a rock.
Yeah, that's probably okay.
Unless it's the Bendu. Or the actual rock. In which case, he will probably beat you up back. And we'll talk to you next Tuesday.